So last time I promised to explain how the SYZ vibration arises from S-duality. And so I remind that we found that S-duality implies with a mirror symmetry that in the Hitchian moduli space for group G and Hitchian moduli space for the dual group, and more precisely, the mirror symmetry had to do with a B model in complex structure called J, in which the moduli space is actually the same as the moduli space of stable flat connections for the complexified group. And then on the other side, we need to choose a complex structure K. And here's the A model. Well, one can, of course, exchange the A and B, but it doesn't really matter. Say here's going to be B, here's going to be A. Now, it's known on general grounds that in such cases, there is an SYZ vibration. Well, there's a special Lagrangian vibration of either of these manifolds. Okay. So, so in general grounds, we know that there is a special Lagrangian vibration known as SYZ vibration for either of those manifolds. And the way, the way to find it is to look at, say, if you look at B brain, the simplest B brain, the zero brain, then it must correspond to some particular A brain here, which we might assume as well as some special Lagrangian submanifold. And we know something about this object, about the point on the manifold. It, you know, it's moduli space. If you start deforming it, you're going to get a whole moduli space, and this moduli space is this manifold. Right? So on the other hand, if you start deforming an A brain, well, you're going to deform the Lagrangian submanifold, and you're going to also vary the flat connection on it. It must be some flat rank one connection. And from this one, we can infer that actually this manifold can be thought of as a, this manifold, therefore, must be the same as the moduli space of deformations of a some special Lagrangian submanifold regarded as the object of the Foucault category. Furthermore, one can deduce from this that actually that the special Lagrangian vibration is a special Lagrangian submanifold of torus. And therefore, in its moduli space, in this Foucault category, is always a, looks like a vibration over some base, and therefore this must be a vibration over some base, the SYZ vibration. Now, this doesn't tell us how to find this SYZ vibration, because if you don't understand sufficiently well this map. Actually, S-duality in this case tells you what the vibration is. And determine the SYZ vibration need extra information, which we know from gauge theory, and that we know something about this mirror symmetry. First of all, what we know is that certain we know how certain operators in the gauge theory map under, and the operators which we know how they map are basically the ones which parameterize the vacuum of the theory. So, and some subset of these operators are, well, suppose let G be GLM. Simplify matters. So then the operators which we know how to map are basically traces of some particular traces of powers of the Higgs fields. And in particular, among those, we have this, our field which is called phi z, the 1-0 part of the Higgs field along C, along the curve C. And, you can take trace of any power, and under mirror symmetry, it maps to itself. We should put hat, maybe dual field. So, So this, well, turns out, well, for any k. So that's because expectations value of this operator is parameterized the vacuum of the theory when considered on R4 instead of product of Riemann surfaces, and the moduli space better match. And these guys all have different transformation properties and the symmetry, so they must map just like this. There's no other way to map them. So similar things hold also for other groups. One just needs to take the field phi z, which is takes values in the adjoint representation, and take all invariant gauge invariant polynomials in the field phi. Well, the group is self-dual here, right? So it's a matrix of the same side. It's not the same field, though, right? So so what I'm saying is that under mirror symmetry, under S-duality, well, this operator correlates with this operator because quantum correlates with that operator. It's kind of the most boring mapping imaginable. By the way, it's not always true that if the group is self-dual, then the mapping is boring. For example, it turns out for the exceptional groups, G2 and F4, the map is not identity, even though they're... So there's some involution. There's some involution on the space of gauge invariant polynomials, and the map involves this involution. But for GLN, it's just the most naive identification. So what do we learn from this? Well, functions can be thought of as holomorphic functions on the Hitchin moduli space. Well, holomorphic not in this complex structure, but in another complex structure. Complex structure I, which are called I. So on one hand, it can be thought of as well, remember the field phi, one of the Hitchin equations implies that phi covariant differential phi with respect to the anti-holomorphic coordinate was zero, so it's a holomorphic section of the adjoint bundle. So this guy is actually a holomorphic section of the canonical line bundle of the curve C to the power L. So, but we can think of this map from A phi to trace phi to the L as as a function on the Hitchin moduli space with values in this vector space. So this function is actually holomorphic, but not in this complex structure, but in other complex structure, because it involves this phi z, and phi z is one of the holomorphic sort of coordinates in complex structure I. So it's a holomorphic function on the Hitchin moduli space in complex structure I. Now, so in this way, we get a map from Hitchin moduli space to the direct sum of this cohomology group. Well, in the case of GLN, from 1 to N, well, these are the independent ones. And this is just some vector space. And turns out that this map, well, first of all, it turns out this one can easily compute the dimension of this vector space, actually half the dimension of the Hitchin moduli space. And second, its fibers, as shown by Hitchin, was actually always some complex story, more precisely abelian varieties. But one has this picture that we have this vector space, which we call V. And it's a vector space. And Hitchin's moduli space projects, and the fiber is just some complex torus, some abelian varieties. Generic fiber. So this vibration is has lots of singularities, but generic fiber is a complex torus. Now, well, yeah, the map is onto, actually, also shown by Hitchin. So, now, well, it's complex vibrations, kind of not very useful for us, or so it seems. But it turns out it's not easy, it's not hard to show that actually not only complex and complex structure I, but it's also Lagrangian with respect to complex symplectic structure. So this fiber is Lagrangian. To complex symplectic structure omega I, which is like omega j plus I omega k. So it was something like trace. So so it's actually well, because of that, of course, and that's certainly Lagrangian with respect to omega k and or omega j. And it's also actually special Lagrangian because any complex submanifold of the hyperkalian manifold, which is Lagrangian, is actually also special Lagrangian. What we find, well, there's an obvious candidate for the SYZ vibration. This candidate is simply given by this Hitchin vibration. And now we can argue that indeed this is the SYZ vibration in the following way. So we have actually two moduli spaces, one for the group G, one for the dual group. Suppose we consider some zero brain. There's a point on the moduli space which projects some point on the base. Now, this point is localized on the base, and therefore, since the operators, well, since the sort of mirror symmetry identifies this base with this base point by point, it means that whatever A brain this zero brain maps to must be localized at the point on the dual base obtained by this map. So therefore, it just has to be some A brain, well, at least suppose the fiber is smooth, because in general it's complicated to see what's going on. Suppose the fiber is smooth, and therefore it must be a complex torus. Now, then the only A brain which can be concentrated on this space is on the submanifold is a rank one Lagrangian, well, is a rank one unitary connection on this torus. So therefore, well, that means that this vibration is a SYZ vibration. Okay. Well, simply because, the only A brains we know, well, the only all A brains basically are Lagrangian submanifolds with flat, unitary flat connections. Now, it localized here, so it must be supported here. Well, it could have some higher rank flat connection, but the moduli space then wouldn't match simply by dimension. So it has to be simply the rank one unitary system. So anyways, you vary this now. Well, actually, that's the standard argument in SYZ. So, and then the point is that as you vary this guy here, you must vary this torus as well as the flat connection here. So this isn't the SYZ vibration. Okay. Yeah, actually, yeah, this point actually, and furthermore, because the moduli space should match, that means that the moduli space of flat connections here is this dual fiber. Because as you modify, if you deform this Lagrangian submanifold while keeping its projection here, just deforming its flat connection, and here you must deform this point, right, while keeping its projection to the base, and therefore this moduli space, the moduli space of this point, which is this fiber, must be the moduli space of must be the Jacobian of this torus. Yeah, so let's see. So this is going to be F, for this point F, point P. That's P, and this is, dual point. And, let's apply mirror symmetry. Right, and from this we see that, the A brain here, yeah, So F to the Jacobian of this F of P must be F of P. Simply guess because that's the moduli space of A brains, which has carries rank 1 unitary bundle and projects to this point. Okay. Right, yeah, that means that this torus is the dual of that, and vice versa. That's the definition of SYZ. The definition is simply that, you know, if you start with a point, right, on a one moduli space, it must map to some Lagrangian submanifold, right? And the moduli space of that Lagrangian submanifold with flat rank 1 flat connections must be the original manifold, right? And that's how you get this SYZ fibration. Okay. And we see now that points map simply to Lagrangians which wrap the fiber of the Hitchin fibration. Therefore, the Hitchin fibration is this SYZ. Therefore, this Hitchin fibration is this SYZ fibration, and vice versa. Is this high rank stuff? Okay. No. Well, you better ask Eric, I think. Singularities of the fibration? Well, I think. So in the case of say, I think in the case of say P1 with ramifications, it's kind of easy to understand the modulus. Yeah. If you look at the case with the ramification, take a simple curl like P1 but with a ramification, similar issues arise. And you can ask, okay, what does it mean to have a dual fiber, right? When the fiber is singular. So I think actually in this case, Arinkin actually made sense of this and actually proved that indeed this notion of duality for as an example, yeah. I don't know what I'm going to say in general about singularity of this vibration. Certainly there are. Okay, so that's basically all I want to say about the SYZ, how SYZ definition of mirror symmetry arises from S-duality. So, well, but one can, as I mentioned before, one can also infer from gauge theory. Yeah, right. Only the smooth case. Right, in general, physically, I don't really know what to say about the case when the lives on some non-smooth fiber. So, yeah, right, yeah. Right. Right, by the way, the statement of this vibration, well, the fact that this is a T-dual toroid also means that if you look at the complex structure I, where they're complex story, then there's a sort of Fourier-Mukai transform between this moduli space and that moduli space. And therefore, B brain in complex structure I for this moduli space must be modulus, equivalent to B brains in complex structure for this modulus space. So this is, well, if you remove the singular fibers, that's what has been shown by Hazel Tadeus and Donaghy Pantev and Hitchin. It's a simpler statement than the Langevin duality, but it will be interesting, of course, to understand what happened with singular fibers. We do believe that the derived category of coherent sheaves of this guy equivalent in complex structure I, but it's difficult. So, and by the way, this statement also has generalizations to n equals 2 gauge theories. So for all of them, there's some analog of Hitchin vibration, but for some of them, it's actually, they have a similar picture. You might have some torus vibration in them. The S duality might exchange, might be Fourier fiber or Fourier Mockai transform. So this picture has generalizations to other gauge theories. Yeah, the ones which are conformal. Okay. Now next I want to discuss a topic which is kind of closer to physics, namely the subject of line and loop operators. The simplest example of a line operator we call the Wilson loop exists on the side, on the left-hand side, because once t equals I, and where the group is the dual group. And these Wilson lines are simply traces of Wilson loop operators, first of all. It's some function in the space of fields, which looks like this. Take some representation of the group. Well, we have to shift it to the representation of the dual group. Take the holonomy of the connection. Well, not of the usual connection A, because that wouldn't be Bierstein invariant. But if you add to A I times the Higgs field, that is a Bierstein invariant connection. So its holonomy is also Bierstein invariant. So take the holonomy around the curve gamma, and then you get some function in the space of fields. That's called a loop operator, Wilson loop operator. Now, physically, it corresponds to kind of inserting color electrically charged particles, which is very heavy, whose internal degrees of freedom live in the representation ULR, which travels along the path gamma. Now, actually, kind of important to consider also the more general case when instead of having closed loop like this, consider an open path. Okay. So in this case, this is not really a function anymore, not a gauge invariant function, if you consider the holonomy from one point to another point. So how do we understand it if it's not gauge invariant? Well, so I'll call this a Wilson line. It's a stack representation R of the holonomy of gamma, where gamma is an open path. Well, what this does is not really an operator, because it doesn't map, say, a Hilbert space of theory to itself. It's something which actually modifies the Hilbert space. Okay. So, and roughly speaking, suppose we have some particle propagating like this. This is our time, say. And gamma. So at the initial time t, suppose you have this particle in the presentation R, and then it sort of propagates in that. This is its world line. Now, why do I say that inserting this sort of external particle modifies the theory? Well, let's think about it in terms of ordinary quantum mechanics. So in the absence of particles, what is the Hilbert space actually, the theory on the initial time slice? Well, you're supposed to take functions. Sort of the wave function, the function of all sort of connections and other fields on the initial time slice, call it M3. and with the constraint that it's gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant functional on the space of fields in the initial time slice. Now, when I insert an extra sort of color electric degree of freedom, what is, instead of function, you're supposed to consider, instead of gauge invariant function, you do the following. You consider functions valued in some vector space. Well, consider also, instead of considering all functions and taking gauge invariant elements, you consider now all functionals, tensor with the representation space. Well, let's call this space, I don't know, say, free wave functions, because they're not necessarily gauge invariant. So now we insert some particle in the representation R. What you're supposed to do is you take a let's call some capital H. What's the following? Suppose take H tensor with the vector space on which corresponding to this representation R, and take the invariant part, respect to a group of gauge transformations. Well, gauge transformations act on this guy. Well, gauge transformations are G-valued functions on an initial time slice, but they act on this representation simply by restriction to this point. So it's a different Hilbert space. So inserting kind of this operator in quotes is not really a map from Hilbert space to Hilbert space. It's just a simple modification of the problem. So what can we do? Well, why is it interesting to consider this? Well, now let's look at this a bit differently. Let's look at now line operators more generally, but look at in two dimensions. So two-dimensional field theory. So that's actually what we're using to anyway. A line operator, well, again, it's not an operator. It's some modification of the space of fields. Basically, instead of integrating, so imagine that you have this some two-dimensional world shape, which I usually call sigma. And here I might have some sigma model, which maps this part of world shape to some target space. And here I also have some part of the world which maps to some target space X. But, for example, along this line, this sort of defect line, instead of just saying that they sort of match up, I can say something that maybe this may be isometry of X, and the value and the point here is related to the point here by non-trivial isometry, for example. So, or maybe something more complicated. Okay. There's some defect lines like this in two-dimensional field theory, which are called line operators. And again, this is not an operator in the Hilbert space of field theory on X. It's the modification of the field theory on X, with target X, sorry. One way to think about them, sort of in similar terms, is the following. We sort of used to the considering boundary conditions for field theory on the world sheet. Here's our boundary, sort of the world sheet ends here. And one can think about the line operator, suppose we have some boundary conditions labeled with alpha. And suppose we have a line operator which is kind of parallel to the boundary. So, and further, suppose, we can consider the limit when this line sort of coincides with the boundary. And this can be thought of as some composite boundary condition. So this is kind of, this is a line, some line defect which is labeled by F. Then by sort of taking the limit, if it's non-singular, we can get a new boundary condition, which we can call like F of L. So there's some map. So a line operator is actually can be thought of as a map from the set of boundary conditions to itself. Okay. So well, there's some issue whether it's non-singular. The limit is non-singular, but in topological field theory, there's no issue like that because there, since these situations are diffeomorphic, there's no issue there. So this is really a well-defined boundary condition because the kind of limit is trivial. There's no singularities. Yeah. So first of all, it's a map on. So now remember that. Yeah, the boundary conditions form a category, not just a set. So why do they form a category? Well, we have two boundary conditions. Say alpha and beta. Consider boundary-changing operators. And they form a vector space. Also beta. well, with kind of standard in topological field theory, this vector space can also be thought of as a space of field theory on interval cross, space of states, a field theory on interval cross R with boundary condition alpha beta, because by sort of the conformal transformation, this picture is equivalent to this. So, okay, so boundary conditions form a category, and it's natural to ask, okay, does this thing define a functor maybe from the category of boundary conditions to itself? Well, it does, it's kind of obvious, can be proved pictorially. So, so for example, if you have like this insertion, and you can just merge the line operator with the boundary like this, and this merger gives you some composite guy where on the upper part of the picture you have f of alpha and here you have f of beta, right? Then here you're going to have some sort of, again, boundary changing operator from f of alpha to f of beta, which can be thought of as a definition of the map on morphisms between the category of boundary conditions. Or equivalently, you can also look at the conformal transformation. You can imagine just doing the following. Suppose you have some incoming state, which takes, well, the incoming state here is an element of V alpha beta. And you can just, if this is a line operator, which are labeled by F, then this picture, by general axioms of topological filter in 2D, is a map from V alpha beta to V F of alpha F of beta. And this gives you the map on morphisms. Now this map is also, well, this is sort of associativity, if you wish. Well, it's compatible with composition. So, because again, it's a pictorial proof, you have alpha, beta, beta, gamma. So here I have morphisms from alpha to beta, here from beta to gamma. And compatibility with compositional morphisms means the following, that you can sort of first compose these guys, and that's the usual pen, well, half pen diagram, and then act with this line operator. Or you can first act with the line operator and then compose. So, and since this picture is going to deform to this one, it must give the same map from V alpha beta tensor V beta gamma to V alpha gamma. Sorry, V. So here it's a map from V of alpha V alpha gamma. So, the same map. So this is indeed a functor. So one can think about line operator simply as a functor from the category of brain to itself. Now, functors, of course, can be composed. So there's some sort of tensor product of line operators. Simply by merging two line operators side by side, you get a tensor structure. So actually, okay, so we can also say, okay, so let's say the boundary conditions form a category. What do line operators form? Well, I already said you can sort of tensor them by bringing them together. So they sort of form an algebra. But actually, they form not an algebra, but a monoidal category. So where, what are the morphisms between line operators? Well, we have one line operator, another one. So you can consider sort of ways of merging them. The space of sort of local line type changing operators is space of morphism. Okay. And you can compose them in some obvious ways. So the actual line operators form a category, but unlike, well, case of boundary conditions, they actually form extra structure. You can also merge two lines like this together, and that gives you a sort of monoidal structure on the category of line operators. Well, for the B model, for example, for the B model, line operator is actually, this category of line operator is simply the category of the bounded right category of B model of the target X. It's simply this. So, and you can think of this at, well, as objects here as sort of kernels of some integral transform. So you have X times X, projects, you have two projections on the first and second factor, and you have an object here, you can do, obtain an object here like this. You first take optical derived category here, pull it back here, tensor with the kernel, which sits here, and then push forward. So in the derived sense. So that gives you the composition. Well, this gives you the functor corresponding to an object here. Right, so for the B model in general, that's what it is. So, well, in general, of course, there's no commutativity here, right? Composing integral transforms is not a commutative operation. So, well, and it's clear there's no particular reason for this composition to be commutative. Okay. Okay, now we can come back to the specific problem at hand, namely line operators which come from gauge theory. So we take not just any B model, but B model with target the Hitchin moduli space. Complex factor G to begin with. So it came from gauge theory. It came from gauge theory in four dimensions. And so what any line operator in the gauge theory gives rise to a line operator in this sigma model. What I mean is the following. If you have like if M4 is C times sigma, suppose sigma is a half plane. So you can choose, well, we already decided that, well, sigma is going to have a boundary, and on the boundary have some boundary condition in the effective field theory on sigma. Now, a line operator, which is going to be a functor from this category of boundary condition to itself, is going to be, correspond to a line sort of parallel to the boundary. Now I want to consider a special kind of line, which is actually coming from a line operator in four dimensions. Namely, I'm going to take the curve gamma in M4 to be this line here, which we're going to call, say, maybe L, times a point P, where P is in C. Here's my C. Take a point here, sort of put my charged particle here, and let it travel along the time direction of sigma. And it's also going to be sitting at fixed point on sort of spatial direction of sigma. So if you choose gamma to be like this, it's called gamma p. That gives me a factor, well, it gives me a particular line operator in effective two-dimensional field theory, which depends, first of all, on choice of representation, just like the Wilson line dependent, and choice of p. So it's going to be a line operator for the B model. In other words, a functor from the category of B brains in this moduli space to itself. Okay. So what is this? What is this functor? Well, it's not that difficult to determine. That's actually quite simple functor. So. What it does, it can attach an extra degree of freedom corresponding to this particle, which sits at this point on C. And mathematically, that means it takes some object here and simply tensors it with some object of the right category, say like a vector bundle, some sheaf, simply tensors it with another sheaf. Okay. And what is this sheaf? Well, Well, very roughly speaking, so since this is a moduli space of flat connections on some LG bundle, so we can consider sort of universal bundle on the product of this Hitchin moduli space with C, and let's call it curly E, and we simply restrict, well, to point P here, and we get some bundle. And then we take the associated to this principal G bundle, a vector bundle, okay, using this representation R. That's what the this W is. So the W is simply tensoring with R of E point. Now there's some slight subtlety here, namely, actually, if the group, well, now, a slight problem, like namely only sort of the adjoint form of epsilon actually makes sense. So actually, this if LR transforms trivially under the center under the center of LG, then that's a genuine vector bundle. Otherwise, it's a twisted vector bundle. So it's actually it's not a functor from the category of brains to itself. It's a function of the category of brains on this moduli space to a different category, the category of brains on this guy with some B field. Well, the B field, the sort of discrete B field, it just comes from the... This bundle actually is not a G bundle, right? It has some sort of, the Stifel, I don't have a name, the abstraction to lifting it to an LG bundle is some class in H2 with coefficients in... For SLN in Z mod n. Well, actually, it doesn't exist as an LG bundle. It's some gluing problem. So there are all automorphisms in the center of the when you glue them, right? No, it's simply that locally it's well defined, right? When you try to glue together, because the gluing cocycle is not really cocycle. It might take values in the center of the. See that this epsilon is kind of defined up to some automorphism. There's also automorphisms by the center. Yes, and when you try to right of the center, right? Yes, right. Yeah, it's a particular discrete B field. Right, there are also line operators which kind of change the, well, in general, we can also have line operators which sort of change the type of target, right? In this case, it's kind of very minimal modification. X is the same X, but with a different B. X prime is the same as X, but a different B field. Yeah, it's a flat B field, of course. Yes. No, I can't reproduce right now. So just continue. Also, I don't have much time here. So anyway, so last thing I want to say. Well, okay. Okay, so this description of what a line operator corresponding to a Wilson loop, Wilson line does, well, it also tells, well, first of all, by the way, I forgot to mention that while in general line operators in the B model do not form a commutative sort of algebra or the symmetric monoidal category here, well, these guys do commute because you sort of can exchange, well, the difficulty is this. If you take two line operators, you cannot sort of move one past the other without encountering some singularity. But of course, here you can sort of move around on C and sort of go around in the extra dimension. And because of the topological nature of the problem, it doesn't cause any problems. And there's no singularity. So you can sort of exchange them simply because you can go around. So this is a commutative algebra, or the commutative or a symmetric monoidal category. Well, actually, now we know what it is. You know, it simply means tensoring with the representations. And of course, it means that if you have one such guy and another such guy, you compose, then it's going to be a similar kind of guy, but with a tensor product representation. See? They're not. No, they might be shifting the B field. You can compose these functors from, well, this can shift by one amount, by another amount, by the sum of the two amounts. You can compose these functors which different categories, right? Well, still makes sense, no? Sorry? Well, P kind of doesn't matter very much here because you can sort of move. The answer is no. Yeah. So there's no singularity in particular to bring two points together. Okay. So now in the prediction of S duality, is it a similar? The dual line operators in the different, in the mirror A model also satisfy the same algebra, or rather form the same category. Now, mathematically, these are called, they basically correspond to Hecke transformations. And, I'd like to actually explain the computation that has to be done in order to verify that in more sort of physical terms. And for that, actually, one doesn't have to go down to two dimensions. The question makes sense already in four dimensions. So you can say, okay, here's my Wilson lines in four dimensions. We know the algebra is sort of a classical, it's a trivial sort of fact that if you just bring them close together, the same. So if you have two quarks in representation R1 and R2, you bring them together, then you expect to get a quark in representation R1 tensor R2. Now, by S-duality, it corresponds sort of using at Hooft operators, which Sergey talked about, on H. Now, maybe I should put L here. And these are sort of dual operators. And they live already in different gauge theory with gauge group G. Now we expect then the set Hooft operators by S-duality they must form the same symmetric monoidal category, namely the category representation of the dual group of LG. So how to actually check this? Okay. The first step in verifying this is actually to understand how to actually assign. It's convenient. Well, let's actually try to understand why. Here, the fact that there is a representation around is kind of obvious. We actually insert a representation of this of the dual group when you define the Wilson operator. Here, the representation actually doesn't enter. Its highest weight determines the singularity in the gauge field. So first thing to ask is, how do we actually see representation space? Okay. Now, to see what's going on, well, let's think about how do we see actually this representation space here, right? This is just an abstract operator. How do we actually see this vector space of the representation? Well, we can consider, for example, how do we assign a vector space to this thing. We can consider, for example, quantizing the theory on some manifold M3 tensor, times R, and let this line run, be a point on M3, and run along R. And then when you quantize, you get some vector space of states. And perhaps if you choose boundary conditions appropriately on this M3, which has a boundary, then the only sort of degrees of freedom which contribute are precisely the degree of freedom of the quark, and you're going to get the representation LR. Now, there's actually a way to do this. So one can work in a compact situation, that is, take M3 to be compact. But it's actually even easier to take M3 to be a half space. And so this point, well, our Wilson operator will correspond to some point here, or Wilson or at hoop, depending on which side. And basically, in this simple geometry, the only degree of freedom that you have is actually the degree of freedom of this quark. So we expect the vector space of this, well, so the boundary condition here, we're going to be like this. That's the only remaining thing. Let me just simply phi equals 0. So the fixed field phi. And far from the, far from this wall, all the fields decay. So that's the geometry. The nice thing about this boundary condition is that actually it's as dual. So as duality maps this boundary condition to itself. So if this is the Wilson operator notation LR, so as duality maps it to exactly the same picture, but now we have a Hooft operator in a different gauge group, gauge theory. Now, the first thing to verify actually that indeed, if you quantize the theory with gauge group G in the presence of a Hooft operator, you're going to get a vector space corresponding to this representation, dual R. Okay. And then you can insert two. Three. Well, there's just everything decays when you're far from the boundary. You don't. Okay, so they're fixed by Beresty symmetry. You just need to specify this, and the Beresty symmetry fixes the rest. Kind of Neumann conditions. So sort of roughly speaking, this is like Dirichlet infinity, and this is Neumann for the gauge field here. So okay. So how do we actually do the quantization? Well, we have to sort of if M3 were compact, we would do the following. We would consider the moduli space of vacua of the theory, first of all. And then consider its cohomology. And that would be the space of states of this theory. Now here, it's actually much the same, even though the space is non-compact. So one can, space of solutions of the BPS equations can again be determined. It's in general non-compact. Let's look for the implicit G is equal to SU2. And let's even pick the simplest representation, or the dual representation. So LR is two-dimensional representation of the dual group. Okay. So I guess I want to think about it as PSU2, because I want the dual group to be SU2, and then this is a valid representation. So, how do we actually solve, what are the BPS equations? BPS equations become Bogomolny equations in this situation. Look like this. And phi naught is simply the component of the one form phi along the time direction, which is suppressed. All other components of phi simply vanish. So this is the equation we're supposed to solve. Now, they have a singularity here. Both the Higgs field and the gauge field have a singularity prescribed by this datum. Okay, and what's the moduli space? Well, instead of solving the theory in a half space with this boundary condition, it's kind of easier to sort of double, what do you call it? is a sort of the fact that this phi equals zero is a fixed point of the symmetry, phi goes to minus phi. And simply consider sort of mirror, and where, well, and just to ensure that this condition is satisfied, like this. First consider general solutions on R3, and then impose the symmetry so such that the symmetry acts by reflection, the sort of mirror, and negating the sign of phi. So it's easier. So if you consider the situation, then you have now two singularities, okay, both of the same kind. And the moduli space in this case actually is well known. It's computed by Kronheimer, and the moduli space is four dimensions, usually hyperkähler. It's then simply like a tangent bundle to P1. Well, why is it like this? Well, see, if you didn't have the singularities, then the moduli space would actually be R3 cross S1. It's the usual moduli space for a monopole moving on R3. And here, the only difference is that the sort of size of S1 shrinks to zero when the monopole hits one of these two singular points. So this vibration over sort of simply S1 cross R3, have S1 fibered over R3 with two places where the S1 shrinks to zero. That actually describes the whole space looks like T-star of Q1, or Iguchi-Hansen space. Sorry? Is what? It's a moduli space of solution of Borgholm equation with two prescribed singularities. Yes, two direct monopoles. Okay. So now the T-star of P1, and then we impose the symmetry, phi goes to minus phi. Okay, we want to only consider those solutions which actually have vanishing phi here, actually symmetric, so with respect to this. And that actually precisely selects the zero section of this. So the moduli space in this case, the moduli space is actually is simply Q1. And that's an example of how one can determine the moduli space, and then you quantize it. Well, quantizing just means take cohomology of Q1, which is two-dimensional. And that's the vector space. It should be two-dimensional. It is two-dimensional. Now, for C2, the result in general is not as simple. So. In general, like a random representation, well, let's take a random reducible representation of SU2. And then in general, we get the moduli space solution turns out to be a vector bundle over P1. It's non-compact. So how do we determine the space of states? Well, you have to take square integrable wave function. You have to take L2 cohomology. And one can show that L2 cohomology is indeed has the right dimension. Okay? The vector space of the right dimension. Say, if you take if you take LR to be a three-dimensional representation, the adjoint of SU2, the moduli space turns out to be tangent, well, actually it turns out to be tangent bundle to P1, so with some particular metric. So you need to take L2 cohomology of that space. It turns out to be three-dimensional, as it should. And finally, now we sort of understand how to see at least the representation space. And now we can ask, okay, how do we see the monoidal structure? What happens if you sort of collide these two singularities? Well, again, now we have to consider, again, half space, two singularities, and solve Borgholm-Molyneux equations with two singularities, and then see what happens with this moduli space as they approach each other. Okay. So you should see that the moduli space decomposes into sort of a union of moduli spaces, if you wish, corresponding to different representations which occur in the decomposition of the tensor product of this one and this one. Say, if you take one representation, another representation, you can take, again, both of them to be two-dimensional. Now, so Sergey yesterday already wrote one important identity, 2 plus 2 is 4. So here's another one. So Here we must see that the product of two-dimensional representations decomposes into a product or into sort of a trivial representation, which corresponds to no singularity at all in the gauge fields, and sort of a stronger singularity. So how do we see that? Well, okay, so we need to now solve Bogomolnik equations on a half space with two singularities. The space is compact, turns out to be compact, and it's some vibration of one P1 over the other P1. If you just had one, we'd have P1, had another, had also P1, and then the whole model space is sort of vibration of P1 over P1. Okay. The way to think about it is to take tangent bundle of P1 plus trivial bundle over P1. And project and take sort of, well, this is a two-dimensional vector bundle over P1 and take its projectivization. It gives you a P1 bundle over P1. That's what you get. Okay. Model space of solutions of Bogomolnik equations with prescribed singularities. The charge is fixed by boundary conditions. The net charge should be zero. Yeah. Right. Well, to actually solve it, it's better, again, to put mirror image here, okay? And solve it in this first on R3, and then impose the condition that everything is symmetric. It's easier. Okay. So, okay, what happens then? Another way to think about it is a blow up of the weighted projective space with weights 1, 1, 2, with the plane. So this has a, well, the space itself has an orbifold singularity, but if you blow up, you know, it becomes this. Now we can understand what happens. We can study what happens if these two points approach each other. Well, it turns out what happens is that the neighborhood of, well, what happens is you get sort of blow down of this. So what happens is that when the singularities approach each other, then this blow up develops an orbifold singularity. It gets blown down. So now what happens with the wave functions, with the Hilbert space? Well, the Hilbert space is four-dimensional, because P1, 1, lower P1, the cohomology, well, topologically simply P1 cross P1, and cohomology simply cohomology of P1 plus cohomology of another P1, so it's four-dimensional. Now, the wave functions in this limit, three of them become sort of spread out over the whole So in this limit, you have sort of a neighborhood of the orbifold singularity, or slightly blown up orbifold singularity, and the one of the wave functions kind of is concentrated on that. And as you blow down, it becomes more and more concentrated. And that point actually corresponds to trivial solutions of Bogomolnik equations. There's no singularity at all. And the other three wave functions remain spread out on the rest of the space. And they correspond to this triplet. They correspond to the sum solution of Bogomolnik equations with this kind of singularity. So, and that's how we see that we have this decomposition. Okay. So, I guess I'll stop here. So, in principle, this can be done, for more complicated representation, but in practice, it's impossible to solve the Schrodinger equation, whatever, determine the cohomology for any case except maybe except this one, essentially. So there are some more powerful methods which replace L2 cohomology with some intersection cohomology, which allow you to determine what the answer is in general. And that agrees with prediction of S-duality. I'll stop here. Sorry, what's the statement? For the single singularity? We can describe it, for example, in terms of num equations. It's actually an orbit in the, it's one of the Schubert cells in the fine Grassmannian for the group G. That's what the solution, space of solutions is, actually. Right, yes. So we have a fine Grassmannian, so every representation, every homomorphism from U1 to G determines some orbit there, and that's actually what turns out to be this. Right. Yeah. Right. So in the end, everything boils down to the geometric select correspondence. The prediction of S duality is the. Well, it's actually not proved that L2 cohomology of the cell is the same as the intersection cohomology of the quarter, as far as I know. Well, this PDEs, well, see, the fact that you get a Schubert cell, at least for SU2, is fairly easy. So one can use num transform and explicitly define solutions of num equations holomorphically. And you can see it's actually the Schubert cell. At least for SU2, it's fairly easy to do. Sorry? I'm not sure. For SU2, I worked out myself, but I don't know. Maybe Kronheimer did in general. I don't know. So, presumably there is some, it's not that, for C2 it's fairly simple.